Today on Wing, some history about counting women's unwaged work.
J'ai pas dit que ça ne comptait pas, j'ai dit que ça n'était pas productif, que ça ne fabriquait pas, enfin, ce qu'on appelle des valeurs économiques.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
That voice you heard before the music was Simone de Beauvoir, French feminist intellectual and author of the extremely influential book The Second Sex, published in 1949. I didn't say it doesn't count, she says, speaking of women's unwaged work, but it isn't counted as production in economic valuation. According to her, the hours of women's unwaged work in France were then equal to or greater than the hours people in the country worked for wages. De Beauvoir was speaking in 1975, the first year of the United Nations Decade for Women. 10 years later, the idea surfaced at the third United Nations World Conference on Women in Nairobi, Kenya.
I'm Margaret Prescott. I'm a co-founder of International Black Women for Wages for Housework and a spokeswoman for the Wages for Housework campaign. The Women Count Women's Work project is actually international, both in industrialized countries and third world countries. In 1985, as part of the United Nations Women Decade at the conference in Nairobi, we managed to get a resolution that calls on governments to count the unwaged work that women do in the home, on the land, in the community, and in reproduction in the gross national product, or what's now the gross domestic product. That took a lot of work to get that through, but it really only began the process of getting it implemented in different countries, which takes legislation.
Spoiler alert, as of 2019, no country has yet come into compliance with the resolution to count unwaged work in its gross domestic product. In the 1990s, bills were introduced in the U.S. Congress, but they failed to pass. In countries where time use studies have been made, however, they tend to confirm de Beauvoir's observation that about half the work in the world is unwaged, and the majority of that is done by women. I'm Frieda Worden. Margaret Prescott talked to me at the 1994 U.S. National Women's Studies Conference, at which she was a keynote speaker.
Thus far, legislation has been introduced in the British Parliament. Last spring, we got a resolution through in the European Parliament, and there's work underway for a recommendation to come from the European Parliament to their member countries. There's a bill in the United States called the Unremunerated Work Act that's right now in the House and will be introduced shortly in the U.S. Senate. There's also a bill that was introduced just last month in Parliament in Trinidad and Tobago. There are some countries who have already begun a first step in counting the work in doing time use surveys, including New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and some others.
Do you know how these surveys work? Can you describe anything about it?
Well, I could talk about what we're suggesting here in the United States. Our bill calls on the Bureau of Labor Statistics to do time use surveys of the unwaged work of both women and men, which is where it differs a little from the UN bill, in the areas of child care and other caring work, work in the home, agriculture, work in family businesses, and work in the voluntary sector, to put a value on that work and to have that work included in gross domestic product figures. And basically what they would do is get, first of all, an understanding of what's involved in unwaged work in all of those different areas, and then develop a value on it. Not every woman living in the United States or a man would have to fill out papers, etc. I mean, obviously, a sampling population, and they would determine the sample size that would be needed to give us some realistic view of what's going on in our rural areas, what's going on in inner cities, what's going on in the suburbs, etc.
So then if we had a count like that, what would we do with it?
Well, we think that the counting and the evaluation is actually critical. In a smaller study that was done by the Department of Commerce in the United States in the early 80s, where they looked at housework alone. The estimate was $1,462 billion per year to the U.S. economy. Yet, as women, when there's anything we need, whether it is comparable worth, pay equity, child care, health care, help of elderly dependents, home care workers, we're told it's all too expensive, we can't afford it, as though we're charity cases. And what we're saying is that this is our money. This is money that we have earned that we should be getting back, at least in the kinds of services that we need right now to make our lives easier and to lessen that enormous workload. Many of you listening might know that the ILO statistic is that women do 2/3 of the world's work for 5% of the world's income. That's a lot of work for very little. And the counting and the valuation, we feel, is the first step in really changing that, because it's very important for the world to know how much work we do as women, what the double day is really about, and in some cases the triple day. And of course, in third world countries, you often have an unwaged double day or an unwaged triple day. And if it's not counted, if it's not valued, if it remains invisible, it's very difficult to get rid of. It's very difficult to get rid of what's not even acknowledged or what's not seen or what is mixed into what is our nature as women, as though this is what we're supposed to do as women and therefore not something that really should be acknowledged for the great value to society that it is.
Now, suppose that this work were counted, the work of women were counted, do you think it would have an effect, for instance, in how structural adjustment programs were carried out or something like that? Do you think it could be used in terms of international economic policy?
Oh, absolutely. And that was very clear in our work in the UN process, because people who live in industrialized countries don't realize a lot of the times that people throughout the world, most of the people who work don't get paid, don't get a wage, but that doesn't mean they're not working. And what it also means is that they're not inside GNP, that they're not considered economically active. Therefore, when it is decided where aid programs should go, where funding and resources should go, often they look at what's called the productive sector. And that's where the resources go. That's where the money goes. The productive sector are those who are inside GNP. If you're outside of it, then you get very little, if anything at all. And so it has great implications for those of us who are living in third world countries. And of course, structural adjustment has just been devastating. We've been hearing from women in the Caribbean region and women in other regions how much it has increased the unwaged work of women, as the infrastructure has really been dismantled by structural adjustment, healthcare, schools, the massive layoffs and unemployment, the scarcity of resources. All of those are areas where women have to pick up the slack. And the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, we think, are very much depending on the fact that women will pick up in our unwaged work for those cuts and for the devastation that's happening with structural adjustment. So it's almost as though structural adjustment is really built on the backs of women, and built on realizing that women will then go out and do the work of keeping families and communities together in face of devastation. But women in third world countries are increasingly saying no. And we're really hoping that women in industrialized countries take a stand with women in the third world and recognize that in industrialized countries, there is a form of structural adjustment that's going on, but it's not called structural adjustment, it's called monetarism, for example. So that a lot of the devastation that we see going on in inner cities and the cutbacks and the belt tightening in healthcare, the fact that the social wage, which are really the benefits packages of workers, are being dismantled, that men's wages are falling, therefore it means that women are increasingly taking on 2 or 3 wage jobs just to keep the family fed and housed, that is in fact a kind of structural adjustment that's going on in industrialized countries.
So, for example, in the inner city, we're seeing the results of work not being done because women are out of hours to do this work not being done in parenting or those kinds of things, and nobody even knows that it's disappeared because it's never been counted.
Absolutely. And in the United States, the Congressional Black Caucus was the first congressional body to take this issue up. We don't think that's accidental. Black people in this country have had a long history with unwage work. But a lot of what goes on in inner cities, not only in inner cities, but in poor rural areas of people who don't have land of their own, also on reservations and in pueblos of Native people, a lot of the work that goes on is unwaged, is outside what Secretary of Labor Reich of the United States calls the paper economy. And he is actually now beginning to talk about a paper economy and the people's economy. And we jokingly say, yes, well, the people don't have the paper, meaning the money. So a lot of what goes on in low-income communities is unwaged, or if not unwaged, it certainly is outside the formal paper economy, not counted, and really setting our communities up to be referred to as unproductive, lazy scroungers, not being able to pull ourselves up by bootstraps, and therefore not deserving of anything we get, or deserving of not getting much at all. So this legislation in the United States, but also generally all throughout the world, the counting of unwaged work has tremendous significance, not only for women, but for any community that really has been disenfranchised and undercounted when it comes to the distribution of the world's wealth.
From the Wings Archive, you're listening to Margaret Prescott of Wages for Housework, interviewed by Frieda Worden in 1994, a year before the UN's Fourth World Conference on Women, and 2 years before U.S. President Bill Clinton signed a national welfare reform law. The topic was valuing unwaged work. Prescott was a keynote speaker at the U.S. National Women's Studies Association conference.
Welfare mothers in the United States have really been used as a political football by either party, Democrat or Republican, for so long. When someone is looking for votes to the right in their politics, welfare mothers become the sacrificial lamb. And they talk about welfare mothers as though the work of raising children and taking care of a family isn't work. And especially when you're living on that level of poverty, the work is far greater than if you have money and resources, and you can pay for ballet and tap lessons after school, etc., giving you more time and giving your children more access to resources and to education. So it's a lot of work to try to make a dollar out of 99 cents. It's a lot of work to try to live off the pittance that you're getting in welfare in the United States. The money and benefits that you get has fallen over the last decade, probably by more than 33%, perhaps greater, 33% was some years back. We find that when welfare is cut, the number of AFDC mothers picked up for prostitution increases. There's a direct connection with that level of poverty, forcing women just in order to feed their children, you know, into the sex industry, for example. But this is something that the politicians don't talk about. And a lot of women, other women who are not on welfare, need to recognize that when welfare mothers are attacked, every mother is attacked, because we believe every mother is a working mother. And if you say raising a child is not work and that woman should get out and Xerox paper somewhere, which might be a job that has no meaning, but that the important work of raising the workers for the next generation should have no value, that is an attack on all mothers, and it's an attack on all women, and I think we need to recognize it as such. And certainly to officially say that unwaged work, including childcare, homemaking, healthcare work, etc., is work productive to society, puts the welfare debate in a whole other terrain, because we're no longer talking about charity.
What about in Beijing at the next World Conference on Women, United Nations World Conference on Women? Since you've gotten this counting women's work in the forward-looking strategies, supposedly there will be work to implement the things that were in the forward-looking strategies. What's going to happen next?
Well, we're actually quite concerned about what's going to go on in Beijing. In the preparatory meetings we have attended, including the meetings recently in New York of the Commission on the Status of Women, what we saw was actually a rewriting of a lot of the issues rather than focusing on implementation of the forward-looking strategies. What was going on was a lot of rewriting and a lot of dropping of issues. Then instead, what really should be happening are coming up with what are the obstacles to implementing the forward-looking strategies, first of all, and also to write new areas that weren't covered in the forward-looking strategies in the first place. We find that a lot of what's being dropped from the forward-looking strategies are issues that are of concern of women at the bottom, third-world women, low-income women generally, and a sort of a shifting up of sectors, you know, focusing more on the glass ceiling issues and women entrepreneurs, which there are a lot of low-income women who are interested in being entrepreneurs, but not everybody's going to make the top of Fortune 500. There are a whole set of just bread-and-butter issues that are needed. So there was a lot of concern by a number of NGOs, including ourselves in the Wages for Housework campaign in New York. We have protested to the U.S. State Department about this. We are also concerned about the issues of diversity and that under the guise of assisting countries in transition, women in countries in transition, that resources are not taken from the third world. So there are lots of issues that we should be concerned about. For example, the preparatory meeting of the ECE countries, looking at the agenda, it was clear that the issues of diversity of women of color in the North, you know, women from the South living in the North, was absent on the agenda. Counting unwaged work was in the draft platform of action before the commission meetings in New York. By the time we arrived in New York and rewriting was done, it had been taken out. We then had to do the work of getting it back in, which we managed to do. But we have discovered that there is a move among some of the Scandinavian countries to actually take it out under the guise of wanting to focus on the waged workplace and getting women in the waged workplace. But there is still overwhelming support. It's present in the Asian Pacific platform of action. The United States delegation in New York did support it, and a rather unprecedented thing happened in getting it back in, and I think it really speaks to how counting on wage work can cut across all kinds of divisions, because in New York what happened is that the United States delegation submitted a joint recommendation with Algeria, which heads the group of 77, to the Secretariat on counting unwaged work. And when it happened on the floor, there was actually a little murmur on the floor, because it's very rare to find the United States and the group of 77 and Algeria in particular working together in this way.
Now, the group of 77, what?
Basically, it represents the non-aligned countries, mm-hmm. and most of the third world countries are part of it. And countries like Tanzania and a number of the African countries were very concerned about getting this issue back in. The non-aligned countries are still a very powerful bloc in the Commission on the Status of Women, and certainly backs this issue very strongly, and we're hoping won't bend to the pressure of the few Scandinavian countries. And one of the countries, Norway, I believe, the representatives felt very badly because they supported the issue, and a particular minister who was new came on board who didn't support it and wanted this focus on the waged sector. So they were in a very awkward position of having supported it before, having begun to do some of the work of counting, then, you know, to have to change midstream. So I don't know how that's going to play out, but certainly the Wages for Housework campaign intends to send a delegation to Vienna. I'll be part of that delegation for the meeting of the ECE countries, the European countries in preparation for Beijing, and we intend to defend that issue. And I think that they will find that Women in the Wages for Housework campaign, as well as Women in the Women Count Network in Europe, will descend upon the ECE meeting. And women will certainly be very upset if they feel that there is any attempt whatsoever to water down that issue or to remove it from the platform of action.
Now, do you have any idea why this is coming from the Scandinavian nations at this time?
What I was told by one of the delegates off the record is that they don't want to support this issue because they are concerned that if the work is counted, women are going to want to get paid for it. And we've heard that one before. That's what we heard in 1980 in Copenhagen. And we're not about in 1995 to go back to 1980. Not only that, the forward-looking strategies was already passed. You see, it's a very political thing. What they should be about is implementing it, not dropping issues and rewriting issues that are already in there. If some of those issues are not resolved, we may be headed for another Mexico City, meaning another UN conference where there is a great clash between the North and the South, between the Western region and the rest of the world fundamentally. And I don't think anyone really wants to see that. So hopefully these issues can really be resolved even before we get to Beijing.
Now, the Scandinavian countries might be trying to put their foot down because they're actually the countries where they would be the closest to women actually being able to get paid for it, because they have higher representation of women in the parliaments than almost any place else, and they have a greater social infrastructure than other places. Do you think that?
Yes, and I must say that certainly it's not all of the Scandinavian countries. It was very difficult in New York to find out exactly who was behind removing this language. We suspect Norway was involved in it. We suspect that this is not a Scandinavian country, but we suspect that Greece had some involvement in it. And I wonder how widespread that is in Greece, especially since Margaret Papandreou, for example, is one of the early supporters of the issue. She's one of the endorsed, even before the United Nations took action on it, and certainly there's a lot of support on this issue in Greece. So we're not sure who's really maneuvering behind the scenes, and we're also not sure how much that maneuvering has to do with the kind of economic restructuring that's also on the agenda. Not only the issue of counting on wage work, but the issue of structural adjustment emerges contentious in New York, and we think that the struggle will continue through to Beijing.
So because the potential for counting women's unwaged labor as a tool in fighting economic restructuring, that this might be why there's a move against it.
Yes, and also there's the rise of fascism. And we suspect that this has something to do also with, you know, them wanting to rethink counting unwaged work, protecting the quote-unquote welfare state from these hordes of people of color, you know, beating down the border, so to speak. Certainly, what listeners should know is that when counting unwaged work was raised on the floor to be put back into the platform of action, there was no outward opposition. No country spoke up to oppose it. So it seems as though publicly people are concerned about taking a position opposing it. Privately, that's another matter. And we certainly hope before Beijing, we could really get to the heart of the matter and find out who's really behind trying to weaken the language. Also, it's unclear that since they lost the first round, they tried to take it out and it got back in. And in fact, it got back in with stronger language than it was in the first place. To see if really an attempt will be made again. The other thing that's new is that the Asian Pacific Regional Conference was just held recently in Jakarta. And looking at the draft platform of action of the Asian region, that issue was integrated throughout it, actually, in language that was clear, that was precise. So as the various corners of the world, so to speak up and really come out for this issue, I think it would make it more difficult for the minority of white countries to then oppose it.
Now, you mentioned that structural adjustment was the other issue that was going to be very difficult. How are the countries shaping up on the structural adjustment question now, and what's in the document or taken out?
There's some confusion, but certainly the United States led the posse, so to speak, on language opposing the third world on structural adjustment. Third world nations wanted language in the platform of action that talked about the negative impact of structural adjustment policies on women, the level of suffering that it caused, the increase in the work of women. And the United States wanted very much to soften the language. And instead of saying that there were adverse economic policies, to refer to them as changing economic policies, for example. Now, at the time the vote was taken in New York at the Commission on the Status of Women meetings, the Western European countries did not seem to have time to do the proper kind of consultation that needed to be done with their home governments before it actually came upon the floor. So there was some mass confusion about what position people should take. And people who were unsure either abstained or in fact voted against the United States. And in fact, the United States lost the vote. Now, we can only hope that this trend will continue, you know, into Beijing. But of course, as the Western region gets its act together more and their positions are clearer on issues like structural adjustment, we don't know if that will change going into Beijing. But we certainly know that once the United States has a position, and a strong position, and a position that looks as though it will not change, that that certainly influences other countries in the Western region, and it alerts third world delegations that there's a problem ahead. And as many listeners might know, working through the UN process is often very strange because you are often in a position of working with government delegations that have very questionable positions in their home country in relation to human rights, in relation to women, etc. Yet in some of the debate and discussion in the United Nations, can be quote-unquote progressive on some issues. And those of us in metropolitan areas who are working in the UN process and preparing to go to Beijing always have to be mindful of what's going on with women in those countries who are not part of those government delegations and whose issues are not represented in those government delegations, to make sure that the strategies and the resolutions we are proposing will in fact be a strength for those women back home. And when it comes to the issue of counting women's work and from the bottom up, that will be a strength to grassroots women everywhere.
That was Margaret Prescott, a spokesperson for the International Wages for Housework campaign, speaking to me, Frieda Worden, in 1994, a year before the UN's Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing. The final document from Beijing took a step back from calling for unwaged work to be included in countries' gross domestic product figures. Instead, it called for development of methods for assessing its value in quantitative terms, for possible reflection in accounts that may be produced separately from, but consistent with, core national accounts. When and where such figures get collected, they can be crucial to one other tentative recommendation in the Beijing Platform for Action, that is, recognizing the gender-differentiated impact of the globalization process and of the lender-enforced austerity measures known as structural adjustment. With the 25th anniversary of the Beijing Platform for Action near at hand, will these recommendations continue to recede from view or be put into action? To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our website, wingsradio.org, and our news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thanks to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the new book, The Maternal Roots of the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.